This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Yesterday, Senate Democrats and Republicans finally unveiled their $1 trillion infrastructure proposal. Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman declared,
"No new taxes, core infrastructure only, and it's great for the American people."
The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act weighs in at 2,700 pages. It will certainly metamorphose as senators begin adding their amendments. But what we know right now is this. The plan calls for $550 billion in new spending over the over 5 years, including $66 billion for passenger rail, $110 billion for roads and bridges, $39 billion for transit, which sounds like a lot. And on the one hand, it is. The bill would amount to the biggest boost in infrastructure spending the nation has seen in years. But on the other hand, exactly how much can that $550 billion buy in the U.S.? Take, for example, the $39 billion additional dollars for transit nationwide. Well, let's take a look at New York City. There, the first phase of the 2nd Avenue subway, 1.5 miles of subway and 3 stations, has already cost $4.5 billion. A second phase will cost even more than that, meaning just that one project in that one city is the equivalent of nearly a quarter of the proposed new federal spending on transit nationwide. Okay, so if that's not good enough, let's do a comparison. In Paris, the French build a comparable subway line. Line 12 spans more than 2 miles. It's got a couple of stations. That whole thing, though, cost around $208 million to complete, or 95% less than the New York City subway project. And it's not just Paris and New York. Copenhagen built a project at $323 million per mile. San Francisco racked up, on the other hand, a $920 million price tag per mile for a transit project. So these examples, they're global and they're consistent. The conclusion is the United States is one of the most expensive places in the world to build new infrastructure. Well, why is that? And with what could be a once-in-a-generation boost in spending for the infrastructure of this country, will Americans get the best and most for their dollars? How much more could we build and repair and modernize if the U.S. pulled down the cost of construction? Well, that's what we're going to look at today. And joining us is Jerusalem Demsis. Jerusalem has been studying the receipts for nationwide transportation projects very closely. She's a policy reporter at Vox, and she joins us from Washington. Jerusalem, welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's talk a little bit about how consistent these comparisons are. I mean, where does the U.S. rank in terms of cost of construction for infrastructure projects?
Sure thing. Yeah, you mentioned several projects. People have done kind of one-by-one comparisons, but the Transit Cost Project, which is a project of NYU, was able to find that the U.S. is the 6th most expensive place in the world to build rapid rail transit infrastructure. And that means things like the DC Metro, the New York Subway, the Chicago L, and we're 6th in the world, even while we're not really attempting very ambitious projects at all. The 5 countries ahead of us are building things that are more than 80% tunneled. That means they're mostly underground. Whereas in the U.S., we're defaulting almost entirely to above ground, less expensive projects. Only 37% of our projects are tunneled projects. And what that means is we are paying a massive premium for even very, very unambitious projects. And if we were trying to attempt the types of projects our peer countries are doing, we would likely be the most expensive place in the world to build these types of things.
Isn't that remarkable? And just for folks who may not be familiar, why? Let's talk for a second why the tunneling versus above ground difference really makes a difference. Above ground construction, I should say, makes a difference. I mean, obviously, when you're tunneling for a major transit project, you're essentially having to navigate through the city that's often underneath a city, right? So it's infinitely more complex. There's all sorts of underground infrastructure to deal with. The kinds of construction are different. So oftentimes, companies have to basically create their own custom boring machines, you know, things like that. And so you say that we're basically doing what? Just a little over a third of projects involve, or transit projects involve that kind of complexity, whereas for some of these countries that are getting the cheaper cost per mile, they're doing much more tunneling. So that means that our costs are even, I suppose, ostensibly even higher than the very price tags would say, just to reiterate what you're saying.
Yeah, for sure. I think sometimes people hear this conversation and they think, oh, the United States needs to be doing less transit. We're just investing a ton in transit. That's not really what's going on here. We spend about 1.5% of GDP on public infrastructure. The UK spends 2%. France spends 2.4%. Australia spends 3.5% of their GDP. And so it's really not a question of are we spending too much, but are we spending it in a way that can actually get us results? And why are there blockages to doing that here when there aren't in most of our peer countries and even countries, many countries that are not our peers in terms of either wealth or legal frameworks or anything like that?
Well, so I'm looking at some of the data that you've collected for your story in Vox, which, by the way, we have a link to it at onpointradio.org, the one that puts the United States as number six in the world for cost per mile, or for per kilometer, I should say, in millions of dollars for transit construction, and way below that, for example. So you have the U.S. at, let me see if I'm reading this right, about $550 million per mile on average. But then way below that, you've got Germany, for example, at, I'm not even sure what the scale is, less than, is it what, $300 million per mile, and but almost entirely tunneled? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the reasons for this are really complex. I mean, you have, I think one of the primary differences between the United States and these peer countries like Germany, you see Belgium, you see France, you see Spain and other countries doing a lot
better.
South Korea?
Yeah, South Korea sure. Way down there, just over $100 million per mile.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, there are varied reasons for this. And one of the most difficult parts of reporting this out is just really talking with experts about how there's not like one simple fix here. There's not one thing that the U.S. is doing that's creating this problem. It's really, amalgamation of things that have to do with both governance and also, culture and, policy decisions that we're making every single day. I think one big one that sets us apart, though, is we don't invest in our public in our public workers the same way that other countries are willing to do so. So in the United States, transit agencies are not empowered to just finish a project, get it done, make sure there's community input, make sure you're following, environmental regulations. But at the end of the day, kind of the buck stops with you and you're able to make a decision. What we've done is we've created this level of just extreme, kind of deference within agencies to potential disruptions. And the thing about infrastructure is that there's going to be disruptions. You build a bridge, there's going to be construction. There's going to be some kind of dust that's kicked up. It might affect someone's view. And that's just the case with anything big that you're building. But, I don't think anyone in the country would say, well, that means we should never build anything. It means that we need to make, cost-benefit analysis, make sure that people are being appropriately consulted and that, people who may be experiencing some harm should be compensated for that. But that doesn't mean that no one should be able to enjoy, an important highway or use an important transit network or have a bridge that connects you from your job to work, because it might create some issues. And in the United States, we have made it such that these agencies fear so much any kind of disruption that they are not willing to even attempt really ambitious projects. And when they do these less ambitious projects, they get delayed way more so than other countries get delayed because they are trying to work in the preferences of all these different people.
Okay, so that question of citizen voice, if I can put it that way, is one that we're going to dive into in detail in the next segment of the show. But before we do that, Jerusalem, you've done some investigation on what might be considered, the usual suspects when it comes to what people think are the big cost drivers in the United States. Like, what about for folks who might say, well, oftentimes construction is heavily unionized work. It's the cost of labor in this country that's really high. Is that one of the things that's making it one of the most expensive places to build anywhere in the world?
Yeah, so I think that sometimes people, you know, bring up unions. Another common one that people bring up is just that, the United States, now we're building them in more urban areas or more dense areas, and that's just more expensive, or the price of land has gone up, or all these different things. And what I like to tell people and like really force them to examine is a lot of the countries that we're comparing the United States to are also heavily unionized or also very much favor labor and also have very dense, cities. If we're talking about France, like Paris is extremely dense. The French, of course, have a reputation for, being really deferential to their labor unions, for labor unions having a ton of power, but they are able to build these things at a much lower cost than we are. So this isn't to say that there's not, something to be done about how unions are sometimes interacting with these projects. I think in certain places, especially I think in New York, there's been some documentation that that there has been increasing costs due to unionization or due to specific demands that some unions are making. But it's not clearly the underlying issue here. And sometimes I think people are distracting from the main issue because it's more complicated by pointing to these easier explanations when there's actually not a lot of evidence that these are the major cost drivers in the United States.
So cost of labor, that issue you're saying is basically consistent across peer nations. Also, the complexity in terms of where these projects are happening, the same. Materials costs too? I mean, people might say, hey, look, just it's getting more expensive to buy the stuff you need to build. Is that relatively similar across peer countries?
Well, it's not that labor or the cost of labor is the same across our peer countries. It's just that we're seeing, like, when people talk about unionization, I think they often say, like, oh, unions are forcing people to, you have a lot more workers on site, or unions are, requiring a ton higher pay or things like that. But, abstracting away from whether or not that's the case, it's pretty clear that other nations have unions. They have these kinds of things, and they're still not paying as much as we are.
Well, we are talking this hour about why the United States is one of the most expensive countries in the world to build new infrastructure and what that means for the $1 trillion bipartisan agreement that's emerging from the Senate. The question is for you, the American taxpayer, are you going to get as much bang for your buck on infrastructure if it's so darned expensive to build here? So we're going to talk more when we come back about why that is. Stay with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we are talking about, admittedly, one of my favorite topics. Why is it so expensive to build new infrastructure in the United States of America? A question that has become even more urgent as the Senate recently unveiled its $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, which could signify one of the biggest boosts to infrastructure spending in this country in a couple of generations. I'm joined today by Jerusalem Demsa. She's reported extensively on this for Vox, and we've got links to her great story at onpointradio.org. And folks, I actually want to hear from you. I know that there are people out there who have worked on major infrastructure projects across this country at any and all levels, whether you're pouring concrete out there in those final forms for, say, a new tunnel, or you worked on procurement, or you worked on design, or you worked on policy further upstream for a government institute agency that was trying to build an infrastructure project, go to On Point, our Facebook or Twitter, which is On Point Radio, and let us know what the process was like, what you see as the reasons why costs are so high in this country. Because really, we want to get the most for our dollars when it comes to this once-in-a-generation chance to improve American infrastructure. So, Jerusalem, hang on here for just a second, because we have been focusing quite a bit on transit, which is a worthy area of examination. But the issue also is very particular to the building of new highway miles. So joining us now from New Haven, Connecticut is Zachary Lisco. He's professor of law at Yale Law School and co-author of a paper titled Can America Reduce Highway Construction Costs? Evidence from the States. He co-authored it with George Washington University professor Leah Brooks. So Professor Lisco, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Okay, so I actually want to ask you, first of all, to tell us the story about I-696. So we're going to do a little rapid-fire Q&A here. First of all, I-696, where exactly is it?
So it's a little bit north of Detroit.
Okay, and why in particular did you want to focus on this this particular section of I-696? What's the story it has to tell?
Yeah. So what we document in our paper is that, like you mentioned at the beginning of the segment, there's been this really, really big increase in the cost of building a mile of interstate highway in the U.S., like roughly threefold from the 60s to the 80s, and then even higher after that. So we wanted to find an example where the geography was pretty similar, but some was built in the 60s and some was built in the 80s. And it turns out it was, in fact, in this particular case, much, much, much more expensive to build in the 80s.
Okay, so for I-696, then how many stages was it built in?
So it's built in three stages. First, in the early 60s, at a relatively low cost of $13 million per mile. But then by the late 80s, with the third stage, it was costing $86 million per mile, seven times the cost in real dollars as the first stage. With the middle stage, intermediate cost.
Seven times as much over, we're talking about a period of 20, 25 years.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, but the sort of, since it was in roughly the same area, right, this Detroit area you're talking about, ostensibly most of the constraints should have stayed the same or similar over that time. Is that right?
Yes. So you can look at a map. I in fact, have visited this area. It is very flat. It is kind of medium population density suburbs, and you know, the areas are quite comparable, yes.
Okay, so then what is the thing that changed between the 1960s and the 80s that made the cost of construction per mile of I-696 rise by sevenfold?
So what we discuss in the paper and hope to illustrate with this example is that this change illustrates the rise of what we're calling citizen voice. And citizen voice has many pieces, but it includes changes in statutes and laws, changes in judicial rulings, and changes in culture, all of which gave ordinary citizens a greater ability to impact government activity outside of the normal electoral process.
Okay, citizen voice, though, that's not supposed to be a bad thing. I mean, in the story of I-696, if I understand correctly, part of the citizen voice that came that became a factor here was, I believe there was a certain neighborhood that just didn't want to get cut apart. It didn't want to be divided by the highway. Is that right?
Yes. So to us, citizen voice illustrates a tragic choice. So let's discuss some of the history here. So Demis has mentioned how, you know, today government bureaucrats are typically not authorized to just, you know, bulldoze neighborhoods at will. In the 1950s and early 60s, they often were and often did. Most prominently, Robert Moses in New York, who built, as head of a variety of authorities, built a lot of the infrastructure. And he could largely do stuff on a whim. And, you know, the stuff was built quickly. It was built relatively cheaply. But people's lives were really disrupted. So a lot of what happened, you know, for a variety of reasons, is that there were cultural changes, partly in response to this. Also, other things which we didn't trust government, like Vietnam. And we changed judicial rulings, we changed laws. all of which let people say, hold on. We don't want to let you just bulldoze our neighborhood, regardless of what we think we need. The question, though, is, you know, is it worth the cost? And that's a question for the public to decide with the available data. And we're still working on accumulating that.
Well, Professor Liskow, if I could, let me just add a little bit more detail here, because, you know, about highways in particular, we did a whole show about the impact that highways that divided communities, again, during the construction of the interstate highway system had on those communities, a permanent impact here. And in the case of I-696, from my reading, I see that in the third phase there was a Jewish community that resisted that kind of disruption, that kind of division that the highway would have brought to the community. And they, in fact, then turned to, I believe, relatively recently at that time, enacted Michigan laws, environmental laws, and they used those laws to oppose the highway and ultimately brought about a compromise in the very early 1980s that included building a plaza over the highway to help keep the neighborhood somewhat intact. Noise barriers along the highway. Things people have seen quite frequently across the United States. Pedestrian paths. Hiring a rabbi to consult on the project. So I guess what I'm asking is, in this particular case and in other cases where citizens have turned to environmental laws, which I believe is the key difference here, right? In the 70s and 80s, we had a wave of environmental regulation that came in for infrastructure projects. They were using, in a sense, the laws for their intended purpose, to have these projects be purposeful and aware of the impacts they would bring to the communities and come up with mitigation plans, right?
Absolutely. That's exactly what happened. So in Detroit, like you said, was splitting an Orthodox Jewish community where, you know, on the Sabbath, you can't just drive into your car and go to your synagogue. You have to walk. And this highway would have been very disruptive to this community. So they built these, you know, very, very large plazas over the highway. They furthermore sunk the highway beneath grade. They built sound walls. All these things add up in costs. It's a lot of why there was a sevenfold price increase. There are other things as well. There was wetland mitigation. Again, you wouldn't have had to do that in the early 60s. By the 70s, you did. One of the laws that this community was using, both a Michigan law in particular to it, but also the National Environmental Policy Act, which was passed early in President Nixon's term, and it allowed people to sue and to say, we do not think that you government planners have done an adequate enough job of considering all the environmental impacts in what came to be called the environmental impact review. And, you know, the statute doesn't say specifically what needs to be considered, but the statute, as well as subsequent, you know, cases, let people say, you know, we think that this will have XYZ environmental impacts. And if a judge agrees, then the case can, the project can be held up or required to change. And part of what happens Part of what's happened is that, knowing that this could happen down the road, projects become more expensive even at the outset, anticipating that, you know, trying to reduce the likelihood of litigation down the road.
Okay. So I just want to reiterate one thing, and then Jerusalem, I'm going to turn back to you here, because Professor Liskow, in your paper, I mean, you have these fascinating graphs that show different cost drivers for infrastructure projects. Hourly wage, what else do we have here? Material costs, things like that. And you find that those, when, inflation adjusted, essentially stay relatively flat, but highway spending overall per mile after 1975 starts curving upward dramatically. So it sounds like what you're saying is one of the main things to look at is this slate of state and federal regulation passed at that same time, the National Environmental Policy Act that you're talking about. There's also the National Historic Preservation Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Clean Water Act, that those are the things that may have contributed to the rising cost of construction of infrastructure. So Jerusalem, let me turn to you here, because you mentioned this in depth in your story too. These were laws put into place to protect the environment, to protect people. Is there sort of a dark side to all of this?
Yeah, and I think this is really important to get here, because I think there's two big parts of this conversation. One is, how should we be ensuring that people's personal rights, whether it's making sure their neighborhood isn't bulldozed through or environmental protections, how should those things be enforced? Because it's not the case that the U.S. is like the world leader in environmental regulation. Other nations that have lower transit costs than us are able to have environmental protections, but they don't force their citizens to sue and go through like litigation processes to protect these things. They have, agencies that are empowered to ensure that the government is paying attention to this. And also they elect officials that are engaged and appoint officials that are engaged on these questions. So I think, we shouldn't create a false choice here that you either have to protect the environment or you can have low transportation costs. That's not what's happening in other nations. And the second thing here is just really thinking through the types of people that often are willing to take advantage of this. The average person, may not even be aware that a new transit project is happening in their area, let alone organize the money, the effort, the time to sue. So the people who are able to do these things are often much wealthier people, often people who have a financial stake in the changes that are going on here. And so, while it's true that often these laws were put in place to defend, to make sure that people who are marginalized could defend themselves, that is not what we're seeing in practice. We've seen people use these laws, like National Environmental Protection Policy Act in particular, to try to stop solar farms from being built, to try to stop wind farms from being built, to try to defend parking lots. These are not environmental protections. These are often being used to protect the interests of wealthy Americans. There's one clear example from, my own life. I grew up in Maryland, and there was a proposed plan to build a light rail across the county. And it was supposed to be, a massive boon, especially to domestic workers. The immigrant rights community was really largely in favor of this project because it would help domestic workers get to work faster and it would save them time. Usually they were taking, potentially even up to 2 hours to get to their work from home on the bus. And this light rail would have taken them a half hour instead. What ends up happening is that wealthy residents of a wealthy suburb in Chevy Chase, start claiming that there is some endangered, amphipod or some, species of an invertebrate that is going to be endangered if we put this transit line up. Years of litigation follow. There's no evidence that this ever existed, and they move on to different arguments to continue delaying the project and driving up costs. To this day, I moved to the county in 1999, and to this day, the light rail is still not finished being built. And it's primarily on the shoulders of people who are claiming that there's environmental harm or they're using an environmental process to stop a project, but there's actually not an environmental concern there. So I think there's this broader question here of, when you create a legal framework that empowers wealthy people to sue when they feel like their interests are being harmed, who are we actually benefiting? Are we benefiting the public at large or just these select few individuals who may have to deal with construction problems?
Point taken on that, because we've seen time and again examples of how small constituencies might band together to stop such projects, as you're saying, Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and those attempts, putting that all into the court does definitely drive up the ultimate cost of the project if it goes through, right? That big mm-hmm. if. But Professor Liskow, let me turn back to you, because I hear what Jerusalem's saying. And then on the other hand, the very example that I started with you when we brought you into the show was not that. It was a community trying to save itself from basically destruction by a highway. And what ended up happening is the highway got constructed, but there were these design changes, these additions, the plaza, the pedestrian walkway, those kinds of things, which actually, from my 2021 eyes, seems to be exactly the right kind of thing we need for major infrastructure projects. So I just wonder how you view how the these laws in the beginning, since the mid-70s, have been used, and if if we ought to change them, per Jerusalem's point, what are other countries doing right that have equivalently strong or even stronger environmental protections and yet still keeping costs down?
Yeah, so these are great questions. I should say at the outset, you know, there's a huge amount that we do not know, but let me give you the best that I can give based on the knowledge that we have.
All right, we're just about 30 seconds before the break, so I'm going to let you talk now, but then we'll have to take the rest of the answer over the break. But go ahead, I'll give you 30 seconds.
Great. So let's start with the Detroit example. So you look at it, and it looks good. You know, if you have a highway nearby your house, that's what you want. You want a 700-foot plaza over top of it. But here's the question. Is that worth it? Could you just have a short little bridge over the highway? And that's the kind of questions that we need to ask across all infrastructure projects. The things are good, but are they worth the cost?
Okay, so we're going to talk more then about, again, in more detail, what other countries are doing that are helping to keep costs down. I'm joined today by Zachary Lisco and Jerusalem Demsis. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's a big week in the United States for infrastructure. So similarly, a big week at On Point for infrastructure. Tomorrow, we're going to be taking a look at the experience of pedestrians in the United States, because for years, pedestrian fatalities were declining. But then around 2009, they began to shoot up again. Many reasons for that. We're going to be talking about that tomorrow, but we want to hear from you. Have you been involved in an accident or a crash as a pedestrian or a driver? What do you think are the things that cause that? Road design, street design, car design? How can things be improved to make walking in this country safer? Leave us a voicemail with your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are taking a deep look at why construction costs for new infrastructure in the United States are so high. This is one of the most expensive places in the world to build new infrastructure. It's a question that's become even more urgent following the release of the bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure spending bill that the Senate just put out. And we're getting a lot of comments here for people who are wondering why Americans aren't getting the bang for their buck when it comes from infrastructure spending. We got Alan Moore, who says, I have experience on building bicycle and pedestrian paths. There are many reasons why it's so expensive. Public authorities put out a price ahead of time of what the project can cost, so contractors always bid to the highest price. Terry Fortman says, costs are high because, in my experience, competitive bidding does not exist. Collusion among companies doing infrastructure work is the problem. And Leslie Mars is saying, talk about where the money goes. Countries with strong unions do pay their union workers well, yet the projects cost much less. Now look at how much the company's upper echelons personnel make, i.e. CEO, CFO, in the U.S. versus countries like France and Germany. So Leslie there talking about executive compensation in the United States. I'm joined today by Jerusalem Demsis. She's a policy reporter for Vox, who's reported extensively on the cost of construction in the United States. Zachary Lisco is with us as well. He's a law professor at Yale and co-author of a fascinating paper titled, very straightforwardly, Can America Reduce Construction Costs? So, Jerusalem and Professor Liskow, hang on here for just a second, because this big picture question of situating the United States globally, not just in terms of cost, but what it could learn, is really an important one. So we had mentioned New York City a little earlier as the most expensive place to build a subway tunnel in the United States. Question is, why?
New Yorkers think that they're the best city in the world, the biggest city in the world. Don't tell them about Tokyo. And as a result, the ability of New York to learn even from the rest of the United States is limited.
That's Alon Levy, transit researcher and fellow at the Marin Institute for Urban Management at New York University. Levy is one of the creators of the Transit Costs Project, which tracks transit construction costs in more than 50 countries. And in Levy's view, New York is just one example of a national problem, the myth of American exceptionalism.
So the United States is certainly self-perceiving as the center of the world. And the center does not learn from the periphery.
Levy draws parallels to Europe, particularly Spain, which is known for, now, cost-effective subway construction.
When they started designing the system in the 1980s for opening in the early 90s, they knew that Spain was in the periphery of Europe. So they copied what at the time seemed the best about France and Germany.
The result? In just 4 years, Madrid built 35 miles of rail at the low cost of $65 million per mile. Remember that mile-long New York City subway line that was $2.5 billion per mile. So the comparison is stunning. And Levy says the United States should take note.
I've literally never seen any effort in the United States to send, for example, Hispanic Americans or who are bilingual to learn, say, engineering or anything like that in a Spanish-speaking country. Even though, again, the quality of engineering in Spain is very good.
That's Alon Levy, transit researcher at New York University's Marin School for Urban Management. Okay, Professor Liskow, this sort of gets us back to that question of what you ought to think regarding the regulation side of things, because we were talking about the effect, maybe the unintended consequence of all that environmental regulation from the 1970s as part of the story here. Do you have any ideas on what the U.S. could learn from how similar situations are handled in Europe or parts of Asia?
Yes. So, and I'll echo Jerusalem's excellent point from earlier. Europe builds these things at lower cost, but Europe is not known for its poor environmental quality. What distinguishes the U.S. from Europe, it's not that we have higher labor costs, to have a worker work for an hour. We don't have higher material costs. One thing that does distinguish us is our legal system and how it's evolved over time. So we have a legal system that is highly litigious, highly adversarial, and gives citizens many, many opportunities if they're plausibly impacted to sue. And this was a change. It was a change that started in the late 60s, early 70s. It's not entirely clear how much of what has happened was intended. We can't say exactly which statute caused what. We can't even say that it's not worth it because and we've seen major improvements in the environment over the last several decades. But it is worth asking, is it in particular instances, for particular reasons, worth moving more toward a European system in which people working for bureaucrats, working for elected representatives, elected leaders, are more empowered to make decisions without needing to necessarily hew to what particular people who are impacted say in lawsuits, which can draw things out and increase costs.
I can understand why maybe there's a little hesitation as you're laying out what is quite a provocative idea, because, I mean, the instant that you say that, you can imagine all the voices hearing that saying, I don't want to lose the opportunity to have a say if a highway or a tunnel or a new rail line is going to go through my neighborhood, right?
For sure. So, you know, you're living in Oak Park outside of Detroit. There's a highway being built next to your house. You want to have your voice to say, well, I want a pedestrian plaza. And you want it sunk beneath so that there's less noise, and you want the noise walls. The thing is, you know, these things are publicly financed, and you know, the whole rest of the country bears the cost. And you know, I'm not here, none of us is here to do that weighing. But we are here to help, you know, help try to, you know, put forward the facts that are there on the ground.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, look, we have to ask the hard questions, and sometimes the potential answers might make people uncomfortable, and I appreciate that. So, but Jerusalem, let me turn back to you here, because you made a point earlier, which I think we have to explore a little more, because what Professor Lisko is saying, I think, is an excellent point. A lot of these decisions we drive through the legal system. Mm-hmm. But earlier, you had said one place of massive underinvestment that could actually, if we put a little more money into it or more human capital, that could then bring overall costs down is in the strength and expertise and staffing of our civil service infrastructure, the very people in these agencies, right, who are charged with realizing these projects. Can you tell me a little bit more about how, if we improved what impact that might have on construction costs?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that that's kind of part of why I view this sort of as a false choice. This is not a choice between, you know, whether or not people get heard or not. It's the way in which we allow them to have a voice in the system and make sure that they have a voice in the system. Because if we staffed up these transit agencies, gave them power, these are folks who want, you know, if you're working in a local transit agency, you're excited about helping your community. You're excited about making sure that there is either a good highway, there are good roads, there are good bridges, there's good trains or bus lines available for folks. And you like getting good feedback. And empowering these folks to make sure that there is community input means that instead of saying, oh, in order to be heard by your government, you need to have the ability to hire a lawyer, conduct an environmental review, and do all these things on your own dime, and potentially get reimbursed if you win your lawsuit. Like, that's not a way that we're actually empowering citizens. That's the way we're empowering some citizens who can afford to do it. If we invest in our transit agencies and invest in the types of people who are committed to making sure their communities are really good and thriving places, and that transit helps people get from their work to their home to their kids' school and places they need to go, that is how we actually empower for citizen voice. And I think that the really important thing here is that, yeah, I think Professor Lisko is actually correct that there's some things that there are going to be some tough choices about what we're willing to pay for. But we're not having that conversation on equal ground right now, or even on logical ground. The examples I've given earlier in the segment are that people are weaponizing this type of legislation not to actually protect interests that the rest of us think are reasonable, but often that they are using it to actually protect interests we don't think are reasonable. And to make sure that marginalized communities are actually having a voice, we should be making sure that that's built into the process already, not that we are waiting on pins and needles for someone to sue before we actually start caring about whether or not something is going to hurt or benefit a marginalized community. So that needs to be built into the process in an efficient way, not waiting for someone to sue before we actually start caring.
You know, time and again over the past year and a half, in part because the pandemic has laid bare all the vast challenges the United States faces. Jerusalem, what you said keeps coming up over and over again, that what the United States really need or could strongly benefit from is a modernization of its governance infrastructure, right? I mean, that's basically what you're saying. And it could bring about, in this case, in an ideal world, the added benefit of streamlining of the permitting process, which you had mentioned earlier. It could even make a turnaround time on decision making for all sorts of, you know, the million different kinds of details that have to be attended to in a big construction project. It could make that much faster if you had in-house, let's say, expertise of someone who can turn to the transit agency and say, well, we got to lay cable, right, for the CCTV system in various stations. What grade cable do you need? And the person's right there to answer it, rather than having to wait days, weeks, or even months for something as simple like that. So look, that at this point in time,
sounds a little pie in the sky for me for America, because in the last couple of minutes here, I also want to talk to both of you about, to Professor Lisko's point, how much we actually don't know still about what all the drivers for this huge problem are. Because Jerusalem, in your reporting, I have to say, it kind of blew my mind a little bit when you found that the Federal Highway Administration still actually does not know how much it costs to build any individual section of highway in this country.
Yeah, and I actually got that information from Professor Lisko's co-author on this paper, Professor Leah Brooks. And I mean, I think it's really startling that the government has kind of been very hands-off in this way of not really trying to figure out where these cost increases are coming from. And really, you know, whenever there's a discussion about cost overruns, there's just like, you know, browbeating, like, why is everyone spending so much money? But there's very little effort being put into making sure that we can actually examine piece by piece how much each individual project is costing us.
Professor Lisko, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. If I had, my one ask for this infrastructure bill is to have much better transparency, much better data reporting in a way that is accessible, in a way that's unified across projects, in a way that's designed to be accessible to journalists and to researchers, so that we can learn a lot more. At this point, if you try to read these documents, it is as if it's designed to be the opposite of transparent.
Well, you know, what's fascinating is back in 2017, Matt Iglesias, who was then at Vox, uncovered the fact that Congress had proposed that the GAO essentially do an investigation, a report into why construction costs are so high in this country as compared to peer nations. That kind of got quietly killed in 2017. It finally happened in 2019 that the GAO would report to the House and Senate of the Appropriations Committee on why other developed G20 nations, South Korea, Japan, France, Italy, Germany, were all cheaper when it came to infrastructure costs. And they did it. They filed a report. The GAO filed a report. And here's what it said. It said, the complexity of rail transit construction projects and data limitations, like we're talking about right now, among other things, limit the ability to compare costs of these projects, according to the stakeholders they interviewed. So they did actually come up with some bigger questions to ask. But Jerusalem, given all the reporting that you did, what do you think the way forward is, even just on this transparency question or the data limitation question?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is really, bringing attention to the issue. I think we've seen that rising in salience recently. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg was recently on an interview where he mentioned that this is a big problem, though he did not offer any kind of solutions that the department is pursuing. And I think that, you know, we're going to be seeing a lot more attention paid as this transportation dollars go out, because, you know, people on the ground are expecting this money to have a real impact in their communities. They're expecting transit to become a bigger part of what we're doing to combat climate change. We see a lot of frustration in dense urban areas, whether it's DC, New York, LA or other places, that their government isn't able to provide for the kinds of transportation networks that would really make sure that climate change is a top priority. And so hopefully that will translate to policymakers as they try to construct these bills in the future.
Well, just think how much more we could get as a nation for strengthening our infrastructure if we did bring those costs down. So Jerusalem Demsis, policy reporter at Vox, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Zachary Lisko, professor of law at Yale and co-author of the paper, Can America Reduce Highway Construction Costs? Professor Lisko, it's been fascinating to have you on. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Heard a lot from listeners this hour, too, including from a listener in Maine who says it seems to be mostly local monopolies getting paid for construction. There's such a barrier to entry, not to mention a lack of housing for workers, so local monopolies can charge what they want. Keep those comments coming at Twitter and Facebook. This is On Point.